On this version of the podcast, a distinguished guest and an old friend, John Leo, who was for many years one of the leading syndicated columnists in the country. And then he took a different turn. That turn was to begin a special focus on American higher education, or very often the failure of American higher education. Why were you so preoccupied with that, John?
Well, first of all, I'm delighted to be here, Milt. I've always enjoyed you and your interviews. The turn toward minding the campus, our site, was because of concern what's happening to the universities there and the colleges. They're just going in directions that we never dreamed of before. And frankly, much of this negative business has not been covered well by the educational press. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to set up a site in which you could find information that was lacking elsewhere.
And that site is Minding the Campus, Reforming Our Universities. And it's a major feature at the website for the Manhattan Institute.
Yes, they are good enough to sponsor it, and I've enjoyed it here for many years.
How many years is it exactly?
7 years. I started in 2007, yeah.
You've done seven. But aren't you coming rather late to the party? Because, look, there are some who've been very critical of higher education for the last 100 years, or maybe the last 1,000 years. I give you one quote. Bertrand Russell said someplace in the 1950s, quote, "Men are born ignorant, not stupid. They are made stupid by education."
Pretty good quote. I don't remember that one. Well, no matter how late it is, it's a state in which we're in peril. I don't know if you're aware of that study by Richard Arum. He and another partner, he's a sociologist at NYU, did a very careful study of what students learn at college, and he found out that most students learn a bit, but 36% learn very little in 4 years at college. You measure them as they come in and as they go out, and only 36% are learning anything about reasoning, critical thinking, or how to deal with ideas. That's not a very good percentage of something that costs $20,000 to $80,000 a year.
Well, you expressed some concern as to whether I am fully aware of that. I taught college and university for just about 50 years. And
right.
I took emeritus status 3 or 4 years ago. And yes, I'm more than aware of it. What I often say to friends, and have said publicly very often as well, is if you take a sample every 5 years, you get what psychologists call a JND, a meaning a just noticeable difference. And the difference is always downward. The students that I ended up teaching at the University of Chicago, my last major academic job, usually when you meet them as sophomores or juniors, are almost innocent of what's in English language literature, let alone foreign languages, know barely any history. I did a cultural literacy test on the last day of every one of my major courses with a large student body, and a literacy test in the style of E.D. Hirsch. And one of the items I used was, what are the dates of the American Civil War? Not 1 out of 10 could put it in the right decade. And that's still the case. Quite apart from information failure, the inability to write in coherent and well-organized sentences, let alone paragraphs, is also part of the burden. For all that I might say negatively, there are always a few exceptions, and they represent the saving grace that makes a college teaching still bearable. But it became less and less bearable, and it wasn't just me growing older. It was the students growing less educated. Doesn't the problem really begin, though, in the secondary schools?
Oh, sure. The secondary schools are a scandal. But if you compare what college kids know now with what, 20 years ago they knew, it's really awful. You've read everything, Milt. You're familiar with the Intercollegiate Studies Institute surveys of what college kids know about civic awareness. Well, the interesting thing there is they surveyed thousands of kids at 40 different colleges, and all the elite colleges were at the bottom, Harvard, Cornell, Yale, and Duke. and colleges nobody ever heard of were turning in much better knowledge of civic awareness, and it's there's something perverse about that. Where
well,
the colleges do nothing.
The winds of change haven't yet quite reached those lesser campuses, or should I? To establish that I'm very educated, call them campi. David Reisman, years ago in one of his last books, pointed out that the general flow of change in American higher education begins at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and so on, and gradually seeps into the liberal arts colleges off in Iowa. And I think that's
like
what we're seeing.
Sounds like you're saying they're not corrupted yet.
But it's coming.
Oh, that's depressing. I was hoping that that the no-name colleges were sticking to their guns and that the Heartland was doing better.
They are corrupted, too, but they haven't gone quite as far. They don't have the audacity of their supposed superiority.
I suppose so. But I am really struck by how few people know what's going on the colleges. You know, I go to a party, and everybody here in New York is liberal, as you know. They wouldn't be here. And they ask me what I'm doing, and I tell them, and they say, what about the universities? Then I take a deep breath and tell them all the bad news, and they look shocked. Like, how could this have happened without me reading about it in the Times? Well, the Times doesn't tell these stories. It has a face of education that its readership wants to believe, but not true.
I do believe in quotations. Sometimes you get a perfect title. James Pearson, whom I'm sure you know,
Very good man.
Said, titled an article that he published in the New Criterion a few years ago, quite simply and directly, What's Wrong with American Higher Education? And I think the answer has to be a number of points ticked off. What would you say are the four or five major failings of contemporary American higher education?
Well, first of all, cost. You can spend $80,000 to $200,000 getting a degree from a so-so college, and that's because, I think, in large part because of federal funding, the colleges don't leave any money on the table. They sop up the extra expense, so it's really not a market rate that the kids are paying. I think the cost is one thing. But also, there's not much indication that the colleges take seriously educating these kids. I don't think it's obvious that they're learning anything or that they want to learn anything. They want to get their ticket punched, don't they? I mean, that's the important thing, not knowledge.
Cost, no serious education, that's two items. What else?
Well, the turn against Western culture is very marked. It's currently corroding the University of Chicago, which has withstood a lot of these attacks for years. The NAS, National Association of Scholars, put out a study 2 years ago about the vanishing West, and how Western history, Western ideas, Western thought, studies of how we got to be where we are disappearing. They've been demoted, most recently at UCLA, which had a great English department. Now they sort of demote all the Western writers. It has to do, I think, with the radicalism of the 60s. There's a lot of people who had contempt for America and didn't want to go into business, stayed on campus.
They used to be merely the tenured professors, or many of them were tenured professors. Now they're deans, deanlets, and college presidents.
So you know the term deanlets. That's a good one. It's Ben Ginsberg, whom I greatly admire, at Johns Hopkins, who writes about administrative bloat. Do you know that there are now more administrators than there are teachers at American colleges?
I do know that.
And you know everything.
That's another fault, of course.
Yeah, so you don't need all this bureaucracy and all the deanlets. It's the nature of bureaucracy to expand, and they do it at the expensive actual teachers.
One thing you haven't named yet, but I know that you're very interested in it, is what we quickly designate by the letters PC, political correctness.
Well, yes, that's part of the downgrading of the West. You know, when you supplant American history with global history, you're doing two things at once.
But also when you punish people for what they have to say, and refers not only to students, but it refers to professors as well.
Well, you know about all that. Well, I have noticed over the years there are no debates on college campuses. It's very hard to find one because the institutions of the left really don't want a debate. They look to expel heretics more than to gain converts or to debate anything.
I've been a member for some years of the advisory board at FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. I know that you pay close attention to their reports. And of course, if you ask the people now running the operation, ask Luke Yanov, who's the executive director, well, what have you achieved? And they say, well, we've kind of just kept the flood at an even tide. It's just as bad as it used to be. But if we weren't in there trying to get universities to stop prosecuting and persecuting students or faculty for what they say or write, if we weren't doing all of that, it would be much worse than it was 10
years ago. I think that's
ago.
Right. Don't you agree with that? Or?
I do completely.
Yes. Anyhow, they've done brilliant work. As you know, Harvey Silverglade, I'm very fond of him. And
he's one of the founders, of course. Yeah.
Yes, and Alan Kors, a liberal and a conservative,
right.
Both have done brilliant work. And it would be in much worse shape. I think Greg is right. Lukianov would be in much worse shape without the victories they have. They're rolling back a lot of speech codes, which is, you know, good work.
But even as you do, other speech codes pop up elsewhere.
I expect to be the more pessimistic of the two of us.
Yeah.
I think I'm losing out right now.
Well, remember, I'm a battered old professor who's been through all of this. You know, we're sort of an age, you and I. My education, my college education, began at what I always considered the keystone of the Ivy League, namely Brooklyn College.
Yes.
Right there in my home borough. And I got a pretty good education, all things considered.
I wonder if you would now, though.
That's my point.
At Brooklyn College, because no need to go into the Casey Johnson thing, but they tried to get tenure away from him because he was not the conventional liberal. He won that battle, but he doesn't prosper there because he fought the liberal establishment there. Oh, it's depressing.
But he writes brilliantly for you and for lots
of
people.
Oh, he is wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I hope your listeners will check our site just to get Casey Johnson's reports on sexual harassment regulations and what's happened to them. What's happened to them is that the male is automatically guilty, and the hearings try to demonstrate what everybody already has assumed.
That leads to a number of things. But first, quickly, tell our listeners exactly how they get to the site Minding the Campus.
Well, just put Minding the Campus on Google.
You'll get it.
The site is, the actual address is mindingthecampus.com.
Sure. And it's added to every day. Essays of great illuminative value.
Yes. We can only afford 3 or 4 essays a week, but we have a lot of commentary. We call it blogging, in other words.
Yeah, smaller contributions.
Which is pretty good.
You talked, as your 6th point, I'm writing them down, about sort of a bias against males, virtually a persecution of males, and, of course, on the grounds that they are sexist and they rape a lot of women on campus. In fact,
well,
Casey Johnson's been very interested in the rape problem on campus, which he's shown up and shown through. What's going on?
Well, in one sentence, it's the shift has gone in favor of the feminists, that the accused is presumed to be guilty, and they want more convictions. So the he said, she said problem in rape, why even raped women often don't get justice because there's no witnesses and the jury can believe either side. The feminists are very unhappy with that. In some ways, I agree with them. But they've set up regulations whereby at different colleges you can't have a lawyer, you can't confront the accuser, you're not allowed to talk to a couple of colleges, you can't talk to a lawyer off stage. It's unbelievable. And they are really kangaroo courts in which the male is railroaded without any attempt to hear what he has to say.
But it's in an old tradition. These are star chamber proceedings.
Right, they are. I think persecution is probably too strong a word, but I think it, the chill on being a white male and a PC campus, the designated villain of all groups, means that you're at a disadvantage, and I think it has something to do with the dwindling number of males going to college. There's no way to prove that, but I think it does.
Here's a funny and paradoxical connection. If you go to one major campus, namely Yale University, where they're very busy prosecuting, if not persecuting, males for, quote, rape, and often quotes should be put around it. That's also the same university, and that's where I formed my my style as a professor, my first academic job.
Right.
Was assistant professor at Yale. They have turned into a sexualized campus by administrative decision and by tenured radical faculty decision. They've made sex one of the main themes, and they do that with their annual Sex Week, which involves lectures by pornographers and by prostitutes. Sex has crept through much of the rest of the curriculum. Nude parties are held regularly at Yale and are tolerated, possibly even encouraged by the administration. I don't know what in the world has happened to the place where I formed my teeth as a professor, but I'm very distressed to read this stuff, as I have in the book God and Sex at Yale by one of the main contributors to the Ricochet location.
Right. Well, you put your finger on a big problem, and that is, if you're going to run a highly sexualized campus in which students get drunk most of the time and then fumble around sexually and not know whether consent was actually given, you can't have a judicial proceeding like that, and you can't assume that all the males are automatically guilty. They're responding to two forces, the lawyers and the feminists. They don't want trouble from either. And that's therefore they stack the deck against males.
And you agree that the administration, in a way, is encouraging them to stumble around drunk on...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The boozy hookup culture
exactly
has been presided over by generations of college presidents who are well paid to look the other way. I mean, nobody responsible has made an attempt to tame this thing down, you know. And girls and boys get drunk together. And then sex occurs, and then the women have up to a year. In fact, I've heard of one, a year and a half to decide whether she was raped or not. And then the kangaroo court sweeps in with very few protections for males.
I must tell you a little story from the University of Chicago, which in some sense has been viewed in American academic life as sort of a reserve, almost a European university, where what's seriously at issue is learning, 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 rather than
yes.
having a lot of fun. But they began to worry over in the administration building about the number of applications they were getting or the number of rejects where you'd accept some kid, but he would reject you and go to Harvard instead. So after a while, they made the decision that we need somebody to come in and kind of make a life on campus more fun. And they got a guy from, of all places, the Ford Company, not the Ford Foundation, Ford Motors, who was an executive over there. And they appointed him vice president. I forget what the title was, but we jokingly, the kid called him the vice president for fun. And one of the first acts, I think, that was taken at that time was the introduction of, or at least a yielding to, a request for nude co-ed swimming only on one
yes.
only on one afternoon for 3 or 4 hours. And establishing all sorts of fun places and fun programs around the university
right.
to make the place look more attractive.
Yes.
He lasted about 2 years, and they got rid of him. The kids mocked it constantly. They already knew how to do hookups and
yes,
how to get drunk.
Right. Yes. No instruction needed in nude parties, right?
It's as if it was by a Russian satirist, by Gogol or somebody.
Well, you know, even the great University of Chicago is running into a lot of problems.
Well, we are.
I mean, apparently it has a civilization studies course called Gender and Sexuality in World Civilizations. And an upstart course is Colonizations. You don't want to talk about other nations without proving that the West ruined them, I guess, even at the great University of Chicago.
Well, that's, of course, the great preoccupation, which seeped into the universities with those tenured radicals. And it has to do with the fact that everybody has a legitimate grievance except white males.
That's right.
Everyone else belongs to a group that has been misused by power. Power being ultimately the appointees of capitalism, who are there in this case to mold the minds of kids so that they conform well to what capitalism requires of them as they give up their true humane instincts, or in fact recruits them to join the ranks of the capitalists, because we believe in a certain circulation of the elites, to borrow an old phrase from the Italian sociologist Pareto. And that's the way people think in the universities. Not all of them. Thank God there are always others. They're usually members of National Association of Scholars who think otherwise and and complain or try to hold the fortress, but it's a dying cause, apparently.
Well, you know, the NAS people, I guess labeled conservatives because they kind of hang on to tradition and honesty, they get their magazine in a plain brown wrapper. I mean, they don't want anybody to know that they're members of that group because it would ruin their reputation. They'd never get tenure. There's enormous pressure against conservatives who pop up on campus. So few of them pop up.
One of the articles that turned up recently at Minding the Campus has to do with the issue of tenure and who gets tenure.
Yes.
And whether political tests are involved in the tenure decision.
I don't know much about tenure. I don't even know what we print. But I do think it's time to be criticize it. It's the moment at which professors just stop caring. At the point you get tenure, no one can touch you. You can say whatever you want, and you can ease up on your scholarship. There's no tenure for journalists or interviewers, right? I mean, we can be cashiered at any minute. So I think something like that should descend on the professor.
I'm looking at the website Minding the Campus for the last 2 months or so, and of course there are articles by many, including John Leo. You've probably written about 5,000 articles in your life, haven't you? About 5,000 articles by John Leo.
Yes.
In your lifetime.
Everyone true, too. Everyone accurate and true.
But one recent one is titled "The Misguided Campaign to Protect Women." That's only February 9, just a few days ago, really, in 2014.
Right.
We've talked about that a little, but say more about it. They are actually trying to, quote, protect women by pushing males into rape trials.
Right. The whole idea is it's doublethink. On the one hand, women are strong and can take charge of their own lives. On the other hand, whenever they're around men, they're in danger of being raped or pushed around or drugged or whatever is going on. And I just pointed out the contradiction there. If you believe that women are strong or can be strong, you don't have people hover over them. The Times, New York Times suggests one way to protect a woman from rape is to have a friend come pour a drink on the guy. Or turn out the lights, or turn off the music. I mean, these weird tricks are necessary to protect women. I think more highly of women than that. I think they can take charge of their own lives, mainly by not getting drunk in the company of solo males they don't know much about.
Roger Kimball, the editor of the New Criterion,
terrific man,
which magazine I've already referred to, and the term "tenured radicals" was, of course, the title of a book by him, published over 10 years ago. Recently, he's been writing about the future of American higher education. One thing he focuses on—he doesn't use this acronym—are the MOOCs, MOOCs, standing for Massive Open Online Courses. He's suggesting the financial crisis is so bad that lots of American higher education institutions are going to fold within the next 10 years or so, and will be replaced by what we've learned originally from the operation of the University of Phoenix, of all places, namely do the courses on the screen, and you can get thousands and thousands of paying students who never leave the home, maybe never leave the basement. That will be the shape of the future university. But he says that's really a good thing because that will drive away many of the current professoriate who do so much harm or waste so much time, and only the best will be featured on the screen.
I think that's right. One problem, there's a period of pessimism that has just descended on us about MOOCs, that kids don't finish the course, that they feel bereft without someone to discuss the course material with, it's going to be a revolution. I think that's right, but it's going to be slower than we imagined. I think it's going to be a long time before MOOCs take over.
And what makes us think, what's the basis for predicting, this I think Roger may be wrong, that only the best professors, the people with some sense of tradition, with much true expertise and scholarly skill, as well as professorial skill, what makes us think that they will be the ones who command the screen when we go to digital universities? Why assume that Donald Kagan will be there regularly, but that Angela Davis won't?
Well, I think the workings of the market will work on our direction. I think if you had a choice between Kagan and Angela Davis, Kagan would probably win. If it went on 5 or 6 years, nobody would want to listen to the tripe that Angela comes up with. I mean, Michael Sandel's justice course is now famous around the world. He had a mob greet him happily at the South Korean airport. In other words, his fame, his ability to deal with moral questions on the subject of justice has audiences everywhere. So I think the good will drive out the bad.
We talked about K.C. Johnson a while ago. One thing that's been on his beat, so to speak, recently for you at Minding the Campus is one particular college, namely Bowdoin College up in Maine, which unfortunately for them, was targeted as a sort of typical American prestigious liberal arts college in a study done by NAS, by Peter Wood and his colleagues at National Association of Scholars. And we've got some recent reports from K.C. Johnson, who went up there to attend a conference which continued the inquiry into Bowdoin. Let's look at the case of Bowdoin for a minute, both from the NAS original report and from KC's more recent coverage.
Right. Peter Wood, the president of NAS, with some funding by a donor, did a book-length report on what's going on at Bowdoin. And all of the traditional liberal arts really study areas have been eclipsed by PC junk, and it's astonishing. It was tipped off by the president of Bowdoin, Barry Mills, playing a game of golf and lying with the man who became the donor for this thing. And the gap between what he said was going on at Bowdoin and what was actually going on, and how little substance there is to Bowdoin and what a left-wing operation the whole thing is.
Well, let's look at that for a minute.
Became very clear.
Let's look at that for a minute. Give me an overview of the curricular changes at Bowdoin.
Oh, you're asking an awful lot on the prompt. Shall I rush to my site and see what we wrote about?
No, that's all right.
No, it was basically the same ailment that has beset so many colleges, that contempt, or at least disdain for the West, had taken over all of the philosophy and English courses. English courses, you know, have devolved into taking apart a novel, let's say Jane Austen's novels, for hints of colonization and slavery. In fact, there were huge debates about one ship seen in the distance of, I can't remember which novel it was, and whole PhD theses were done on whether that ship was a slave ship. I mean, this is a preposterous way to read novels. But that's the sort of thing that was going on.
You look through the history of cultural materials, whether literature or the way we tell history or whatever, and you find hidden evidence of racism and of sexism and of homophobia and of contempt for the working class and secret constant exhortation in favor of the virtues of capitalism and, of course, imperialism and imperial war. That's still there, even though it's now more disguised, but we'll show it up in our literature courses. We'll show it up even in our philosophy courses. That's the way the undergraduate curriculum has been altered, not merely at Bowdoin, but in lots of places. But
right.
Bowdoin was put under the light of close microscopic scrutiny, and so we've now got the Bowdoin story. Then what happened at those conferences up there across the street from the campus?
Well, we have an article up today, and the headline is Iced Out. They had a conference, and nobody from Bowdoin came. I mean,
nobody.
One professor and 10 students. And Peter told me that the 10 students were there to jeer and to make fun of the people. So I guess there's not much independent thought at Bowdoin. And the conference was held directly across the street from the campus.
Yeah, so I read. Well, is Bowdoin that special, or is it really an illustrative case of a general trend?
I don't know. It's assumed to be one of the high-ranking independent liberal arts colleges, but I don't know. I don't know if that's true. It's hard to say if it deserves that rank. The U.S. News Report and World Report thing had him as fourth highest liberal arts college, so I guess some people still believe that.
I wish that somebody would do a close study of Yale, or not of Yale, I meant to say of Dartmouth, because the institutions I've been associated with are Yale, University of Chicago, Dartmouth, Ohio State University. That's my whole academic history. Dartmouth, where I've got a number of friends, I only taught there for a few years, but I'm still in contact, has gone through tremendous curricular change. Of course, there you've got something extra. You've got the foundation of student conservative journalism, which began with the Dartmouth Review a good 25 years ago.
Exactly. And I thought Dartmouth was one of the places where pugnacious resistance would still be there. But I think the left is getting the upper hand and turning the corner, even at Dartmouth. Well, even at the University of Chicago, you know, which resisted this for so long.
Well, at the University of Chicago, we had a basic alteration in the Common Core, which in those days meant a good overview courses, essentially of Western civilization. The university decided, just about the time they appointed the vice president for fun, they decided to reduce that by about one-third. And we fought that. A number of us were organized against those changes, but the changes did prevail.
Well, you can't use the word in a vice presidential title. It have to be lighthearted, leisure activity.
It was something like that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What does all of this have to do with the sheer flooding of the universities? If you compare Yale of now to Yale of, 50 years ago, or maybe even 70 years ago, the Yale of Dink Stover and so on, you've got only a small and rather elite bunch of students. That is the total percentage of American students in going on from high school to college level work was probably just about 10% at maximum. Now it's virtually 80%.
Well, there's 18 million kids in college now. It's stunning. You know? That's almost triple what it was 50 years ago.
Well, all history ultimately is demographic change, somebody says. That may or may not be true.
I guess.
But is it true? Is the demographic undergirding of the universities the key to their transformation?
Well, I would say it has to do with simply making money, that as long as a large percentage of parents are willing to go into debt to send junior to Yale and Harvard and don't care what they learn, that they will prosper. That's why Glenn Reynolds at Instapundit thinks this is a bubble, like the housing bubble, that it will burst when people realize they're spending tons of money, like the Dutch did in the 17th century, to buy something very cheap, tulip bulbs. And that the university is not worth that kind of investment. That's what's going to wreck the middle and lower colleges. The elite colleges will survive it. But I think when the bubble bursts, a lot of colleges will go under.
What do you see right there in New York? Another place I'm quite fond of is Brooklyn College, as it was. And the City University, generally, was once a great system. City College of the City University of New York trained about half of the scientists and humanist professors of the country 70 years ago.
Well, that was a special circumstance because Jews and women couldn't get into the best colleges, so they went to the City College and brightened it briefly until the rest of the culture woke up and invited Jews and women into them. So you can't recapture the exclusion that made City College great.
You've got, I think, three children. Is that right?
Three daughters, yes.
Three daughters. Have they all been to college already?
Two went to Oberlin and one went to Wesleyan. And most recent one, who's still in the city here, started a book club the minute she got out of Wesleyan. And I said, why? I said, well, I want to read the books they didn't want us to read at Wesleyan. No, there was famous novels and historical books. So she's okay. She got a decent education because she is ferreted it out. But they had all this nonsense, you know, including S&M courses in which the kids had to participate, be either S or M in these classes. I mean, this is stupid stuff.
My goodness. I've heard about that at another institution near New York City, a little bit north of it, Bard College.
Yes. I think Bard is on a better track, though. But it's hard to judge.
But if you had kids to send to college now, where would you send them?
People keep asking me that, and I really don't have an answer. In fact, that's one of the articles I've just commissioned. I've asked Adam Kissel, who used to be with FIRE. I said, do a piece on eight unknown colleges that you would send your kids
Yeah,
to.
good concept.
So he's working on that, and they probably would be unknown, and the parents would be afraid to send them to a college that wasn't famous. But that's what has to
One
happen.
obvious place that gets a lot of mention is Hillsdale, but that's for people who have also strong traditionalist conservative orientation. That is featured at Hillsdale, as it may not at other good colleges.
Well, I don't want to run down Hillsdale. I admire it. But when you send your kid to Hillsdale, you know you're going to get a right-wing traditional
Yeah.
education and a thumb-in-the-eye approach. And what I'm looking for is a decent college that will just do a straightforward job of teaching the best and not imposing ideology on the students.
What's your overall, your historical view? If you were doing a major book on the history of the institution of higher education in America over the period of 150 or 200 years, how would you account for the transformation that occurred and of which we've been speaking today?
Oh, I think there'd be many transformations. I mean, what many people regard as the good old days, maybe 50 years ago, simply had high wasps going to elite colleges to make connections and prosper. But they didn't open up to the rest of America, and the teaching was probably in many ways frivolous. There are good teachers, but I'd be loath to say that they all got good educations. I caught the tail end of that. I got out of college in 1957. I went to the University of Toronto because the Jesuits at Regis High School here in New York wouldn't send our transcripts to any place but a Catholic college. So I got into the Catholic College of the University of Toronto. But I had Maritain and Gilson and Marshall McLuhan as teachers, and we studied hard. It was the tail end of the post-war really determined studying, and now I don't think there's anywhere near that kind of rigor. At least the statistics don't turn it up. What do you think?
Well, I think you're probably right. I've had one disappointment, I must tell you. I was for 2 years on the board of Shimer College here in Chicago. Shimer is that
Right.
institution which is one of the great books colleges,
Right.
similar to St. John's at Annapolis. And
Right.
indeed, the chairman of the board was the president of St. John's of Annapolis, the board at Shimer. But overall, my discovery was that it was essentially a left-wing propagandistic organization.
They had a big flap there,
They
didn't
did have a big flap for a
they?
while. A very, very well-heeled billionaire wanted to put his money in to transform the place, and brought a good guy, a guy who has written for you a few times, a Lindsay,
Oh, yes.
As the president. But the faculty, which numbered all of 10 or 12 people, rejected him and saw this as an attempt to transform the political tone of the place, as perhaps it really was. So they persist. They do some good stuff. They do read some great books. But in the main, I thought ideology cut more ice than Immanuel Kant, so to speak.
I don't know how we do anything about that. I mean, the colleges really are, I hope it's not an exaggeration, really part of the Democratic Party's base, like feminists and gays. And they don't want to give up any new slots to non-liberal professors, and they don't want to change the curriculum in any way. And since the press won't cover this stuff, you never see these stories in the New York Times. It goes on and on as being a part of the left's base. So I don't know what you do about that.
Well, you do keep covering it, if not in the New York Times, at Minding the Campus. What other publications are relevant?
Well, I mean, the NAS, the National Association of Scholars, has an excellent
Called
quarterly,
Academic Questions.
probably a, yeah, Academic
Yeah.
Questions, and it's very good. But it probably has a readership of a few thousand, and I'd say You can't be seen with it if you're on a college campus. There are six or seven conservative sites, including the NAS site, that are worth paying attention to. But again, it's very hard to build up a big readership on these sites. You can get people, you get parents of high school seniors and professors, but the average person is not concerned about issues of academic freedom. They just don't bear down.
Another good operation is the one that was organized by Ann Neal. What is its current title?
ACTA, American
Council
of Trustees and Alumni. And she does a good job. She's very smart. So you could get to that by just punching in the capital ACTA on Google, and you'll get her site.
And their founding principle is the best way to change and improve these universities is for alumni and parents of students to know what's happening there and to exert direct pressure.
I think you're right. But, of course, you have that Dartmouth example. You know what happened there. They stacked the Board of Trustees when conservatives got open-minded people elected, so they just expanded the board to drown them out. So it's very hard. I mean, the ugly fact is that they can project themselves some reform nine times out of ten.
Is
that too pessimistic?
I was going to say, it sounds like Roosevelt's attempt to pack the Supreme Court.
Yes, exactly.
But they succeeded at Dartmouth. Yes. Oh, dear. Is the prospect essentially the same in other cousin countries, as they might be called, in Canada?
I don't think so, because I think this is something born of the 60s, that a large number of people went to college at a time of Watergate and, more importantly, the Vietnam War, and it took a very sour view of America, and then stayed on at the colleges to impose that sour view on the next two generations. So that's the problem. And I think they're beginning to replicate themselves. The new generation of professors look just as bad to me as the parent one.
Well, I think one...
So I don't know how we break
one
it.
One saving possibility may be disaffected students who've been exposed to a lot of this stuff and may even temporarily have had their whole worldview affected by their leftist professors who teach them contemporary racism as they construe it, rather than the history of anything. But once they're a few years beyond college, many of them begin to see that was really a heavy load of rather distorted history, or a heavy load of junky stuff rather than serious literature. And they begin to reach out for some re-education or some fuller education. Many wise heads have said, my education began after college when I began to see through
it. Well, that's what my daughter said.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true. I think in many ways they keep their heads down at college. They know that the stuff is being imposed on them, that it's nonsense, but they don't want to make a fuss about it. And they just treat it as a bad dream that they awaken from at graduation. So there is
Wouldn't you
there.
Agree that everything we've been saying so far applies essentially to the so-called liberal arts college or the liberal arts portion of a larger university, but not to the serious science programs, not to the schools of business? I can't say it doesn't apply to the law schools. The radicalization and misuse of law is visible in some of the major law schools.
Absolutely. I guess that's right. The science and research facilities are still largely free, but they have their eyes on the research facilities and the scientific colleges like MIT. They're susceptible to quotas by race and gender and sexual orientation. So they're meddling in there too, but so far they don't have any control over them.
They haven't yet reshaped the curriculum as such, I
That's
trust.
Right. You know, the other thing that they haven't reshaped the curriculum, but they're trying to.
Really?
I was going to say that the Catholic colleges have been no bargain here, with the possible exception of Notre Dame. They've all tended to lean in the direction of leftist ideology, and particularly Georgetown, which is a disgrace. I keep referring to it as a formerly Catholic university. No one from Georgetown seems to write in and protest, but it isn't Catholic anymore.
Is Georgetown a Jesuit institution?
Yes.
There you are. What is most visible...
But there's very few Jesuits left.
But they still have some control of the total system. And the Jesuits, as you, as a serious lay Catholic, might or might not agree, have turned very much towards the left over the last 50 years.
I don't understand it. I don't.
But
I
you
don't
do see that as a correct characterization.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what's happening. And I think it has to do with prestige and climbing the U.S. news ranking. And they don't want to be the college that throws out a speech code, because the people on the left will take that as a right-wing effort. So that they're currying favor with the wrong people and compromising the university, I think. We've had a couple of articles on Georgetown.
I think the truth that sends tends also to be applicable to the two Catholic institutions in the city of Chicago, namely Loyola and DePaul.
I think they're appalling. I mean, I think it was DePaul that had the several controversies. I don't dimly remember what they were, but it was about the imposition of left
ideology.
They
fired one sociology adjunct professor for having a verbal debate on the street with some Palestinian students who had a booth where they were hawking their wares. And this guy gave them an argument.
This guy
gave them an argument, and for that, the others complained, and he was dismissed. He did not have tenure. So.
Well, that's another thing. The universities are the national capitals of hurt feelings. Everything depends on feelings. If someone says my feelings were hurt, that's the same as breaking a window and going
Well, that's the commission of a crime. It's called hate speech.
I know, but doesn't even have to be speech.
Yeah. It could be hate eyebrow. Looking with some disdain.
Yes, eyeball roll. Well, the University of Connecticut was the first one that suspended a student for inappropriate laughter.
Really?
Somebody told what might have been, I don't know what it was, an anti-gay joke. And he smirked a little bit, and he was reported for smirking, and he was given 100 hours of community service and had to write an essay in praise of homosexuality.
Oh,
I think it was retracted later on, but I certainly wrote that one.
Well, you have two recourses. One is minding the universities, which is a great recourse to ease your own mind of all of its frustrations. What's your second one, I was about to ask?
My second what? Favorite thing to do?
Your second way of easing the pain.
Oh, I don't know. I read and I watch birds. I'm a big bird
watcher. You live near Central Park, probably.
Yeah, but I go all around the country chasing rarities, too. So.
John,
it's getting rather expensive, though. You know, you can't just get on a plane and go to Sun Valley in the summer to see a Siberian accent. Right. I mean, it's too expensive. So.
John, it's been a delight talking with you.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, Mel. Keep it up.
Well, we'll keep it up in this new form, this podcast form, which is replacing terrestrial radio, as they call it.
Yes, I hope you do as well here as you did there.
I think it is running fairly well. But I am delighted to have made the connection again. Let's talk again soon.
Okay, thank you
very much.